Each time Marisie entered the precinct offices, she got a little thrill. It was the thrill of bucked expectations, of a future denied. Even though this room didn't look like she'd imagined, as the clerical and organizational center for the Octant's constables, it felt more like a business office than anything else. The mere fact that she was here excited her. This wasn't supposed to have been her life. She'd grown up reading stories of the roughs, of lawmen and villains. She'd dreamed of six guns and stagecoaches. She'd even taken up horseback riding and rifle shooting. And then real life had intervened. She'd been born into privilege. Yes, she was illegitimate, but the generous stipend from her father had set her and her mother up in a fine home. Money for an education had been guaranteed for her. With that kind of promise, and with her mother's determination that Marisie should enter society and prove herself to her father, one did not choose a profession so lowly as that of a constable. Yet, here she was. It was wonderful. She passed through the room full of people at desks. Though a jail was attached to the building, it had its own entrance, and she rarely visited it. Many of the constables she passed on her way through the main chamber were the type who spent most of their days at a desk. Her own spot was a comfortable nook near Captain Aradel's office. His room felt like a closet inside, and Aradel rarely spent time there. Instead, he stalked through the main chamber like a prowling lion, always in motion. Marisie set her handbag on her desk, next to a stack of last year's crime reports. In her spare time, she was trying to judge to what extent petty crimes in a region foretold greater ones. Better that than reading the politely angry letters from her mother, which lay underneath. She peeked into the captain's office and found his waistcoat thrown across his desk, right beside the pile of expense reports he was supposed to be initialing. She smiled and shook her head, dug his pocket watch out of his waistcoat, then went hunting. The offices were busy, but they didn't have the bustle of the prosecutor's offices. During her internship there, beneath dais, everyone had always seemed so frantic. People worked all hours, and when a new case was posted, every junior solicitor in the room rushed over in a flurry of papers, coats, and skirts, craning to see who had posted the case and how many assistants they would be taking. The opportunities for prestige and even wealth had been bountiful, and yet she hadn't been able to shake the feeling that nobody was actually doing anything. Cases that could make a difference languished because they weren't high profile enough, while anything under the patronage of a prominent lord or lady was seen to immediately. The rush had been less about fixing the city's problems and more about making certain the senior solicitors saw how much more eager you were than your colleagues. She'd probably still be there if she hadn't met Waxillium. She'd have done as her mother wanted, seeking validation through her child, proof, perhaps, that she could have married Lord Harms if it had been in the cards, despite her low birth. Marisie shook her head. She loved her mother, but the woman simply had too much time on her hands. The constable's offices were so different from the solicitor's. Here there was a true sense of purpose, but it was measured, even thoughtful. Constables leaned back in chairs and described evidence to their officers, looking for help on a case. Junior corporals moved through the room, delivering cups of tea, fetching files, or running some other errand. The competition she'd felt among the solicitors barely existed here. Perhaps that was because there was little prestige and even less wealth to go around. She found Aradel with sleeves rolled up, one foot on a chair, bothering Lieutenant Cabarel.
No, I'm telling you, we need more men on the streets, near the pubs, at night, where the foundry workers congregate after the strike line breaks up. Don't bother guarding them during the day.
Cabarel nodded placidly, though she gave Marisie a roll of the eyes as she walked up. Aradel did tend to micromanage, but at least he was earnest. In Marisie's experience, they were almost all fond of him, eye rolls notwithstanding. She plucked a cup of tea off the plate of a passing corporal who was delivering them to the desks. He quickly moved on, eyes forward, but she could almost feel him glaring at her. Well, it wasn't her fault she'd landed this position and the rank of lieutenant without ever having to deliver tea.
All right. Maybe there is a bit of competition around here.
You'll see this done, then?
Of course, sir.
Cabarel was one of the few in the place who treated Marisie with any measure of respect. Perhaps it was because they were both women. There were fewer women in the constabulary than among the solicitors. One might have guessed that the reason for this was that ladies weren't interested in the violence. But having done both jobs, Marcy felt she knew which profession was bloodier, and it wasn't the one where people carried guns.
Good, good. I have a debriefing with Captain Reddy, and...
He patted his pocket. Marcy held out his watch, which he grabbed.
15 minutes. Huh. More time than I expected. Where'd you get that tea, Combs?
Want me to have someone fetch you some?
No, I can do it.
Auradel bustled off, and Marcy nodded to Cabarel, then hurried after him.
Sir, have you seen the afternoon broadsheets?
He held out his hand, which she filled with paper. He held up the stack of broadsheets and almost ran over 3 different constables on his way to the stove and the tea.
Bad. I'd hope they'd spin this against us.
Us, sir?
Sure. Nobleman dead, constables not giving the press details. This reads like they started to pin the death on the constables, but then changed their minds. By the end, the tone is far more outraged against Winsting than us.
And that's worse than outrage at us for a cover-up?
Far worse, Lieutenant.
Auradel reached for a cup.
People are used to hating Connors. We're a magnet for it, a lightning rod. Better us than the governor.
Unless the governor deserves it, sir.
Dangerous words, Lieutenant.
Auradel filled his cup with steaming tea from the large urn kept warm atop the coal stove.
And likely inappropriate.
You know, there are rumors that he's corrupt.
What I know is that we are civil servants. There are enough people out there with a mindset and the moral position to monitor the government. Our job is to keep the peace.
Marcy frowned, but said nothing. Governor Innate was corrupt. She was almost sure of it. There were too many coincidences, too many small oddities in his policy decisions. It wasn't by any means obvious, but trends were Marcy's specialty and her passion. It wasn't as if she'd wanted to discover that the leader of Ellendale was trading favors with the city's elite, but once she'd spotted the signs, she'd felt compelled to dig in. On her desk, carefully hidden under a stack of ordinary reports, was a ledger in which she'd assembled all the information. Nothing concrete, but the picture it drew was clear to her, even though she understood that it would look innocent to anyone else.
You disagree with my opinion, Lieutenant?
One doesn't change the world by avoiding the hard questions, sir.
Feel free to ask them, then. In your head, Lieutenant, and not out loud. Particularly not to people outside the precinct. We can't have the men we work for thinking we are trying to undermine them.
Funny, sir. I thought we worked for the people of the city, not their leaders.
Auradel stopped, cup of steaming tea halfway to his lips.
Suppose I deserved that.
Auradel took a gulp, shaking his head. He didn't flinch at the heat. People in the office figured he'd seared his taste buds off years ago.
Let's go.
They wove through the room toward Auradel's office, passing Captain Reddy at his desk. The lanky man rose, but Auradel waved him down, pulling out his watch.
I still have 5 minutes until I have to deal with you, Reddy.
Marcy shot the captain an apologetic smile. She got a scowl in return.
Someday I'm going to figure out why that man hates me.
Hmm? Oh, you stole his job.
What?
Reddy was going to be my assistant.
They reached his office.
Had a damn fine bid for the job. I was all but priced into hiring him until I got your application.
Why would Reddy want to be your assistant, sir? He's a field constable, a senior detective.
Everyone has this idea that in order to move up, you need to spend more time in the office and less on the street. Stupid tradition. Even if the other octants follow it. I don't want my best men and women turning into desk slugs. I want the assistant position to be for nurturing someone fresh who shows promise, rather than letting some practiced constable gather moths.
The realization made a lot of things lock into place for Marcy. The hostility she felt from many of the others wasn't just because she'd skipped the lower ranks. Many with noble titles did that. It was because they'd solidified behind Reddy, their friend who'd been slighted.
So, you think I show promise, then?
Of course I do. Why would I have hired you otherwise?
Corporal Maindew walked by, saluting, and Auradel threw the wadded broadsheets into his face.
No saluting indoors, Maindew. You'll knock yourself unconscious slapping your forehead every time I walk past.
Sorry, sir.
Auradel glanced back at Marcy.
There's something in you, Combs. Not the gloss and glint of the application. I don't care about your grades or what those zinc tongues in the solicitor's office thought of you. The words you wrote about changing the city, those made sense. They impressed me.
Thank you for the praise, sir.
I'm not flattering you, Combs. It's just a fact.
He pointed toward the door.
That broadsheet said the governor was going to address the city later this afternoon. I'll bet the second octant constables ask us for help managing the crowds. They always do. So I'm going to send a street detail. Go with them and listen, then report back to me what Governor Innate says, and pay attention to how the crowd reacts.
Yes, sir.
Wax soared through the air above Ellendale, hat held by its strings to his neck, mistcoat waving behind him like a banner. Below, the city bustled and moved, people swarming through its roadway arteries. Some glanced at him, but most ignored him. Allomancers were not the rarity here they had been in the roughs.
All these people.
Wax pushed off a fountain shaped like mists condensing into harmony with arms upraised, bracers glittering golden on the otherwise green copper statue. Women sat on its stone edge, children played in its waters. Motor cars and horse carriages broke around it, sweeping to the sides and charging down other roads, going about the ever-important business of city life. So many people. And here in the Fourth Octant, a frightening percentage of them were his responsibility. To begin with, he paid their wages, or oversaw those who did. On the solvency of his house rested the financial stability of thousands upon thousands. But that was only part of it, because through his seat in the Senate, he represented any who worked for him or who lived on properties he owned. Two divisions within the Senate. One side, the representatives of the professions, was elected and came and went as people's needs changed. The other side, the seats of the noble houses, was stable and immutable, not subject to the whims of voters. The governor, elected by the seats, presided over them all. A good enough system, except it meant that Wax was supposed to look after tens of thousands of individuals he could never know. His eye twitched, and he turned, pushing off some rebar sloppily left sticking out of a tenement wall. Towns were better in the roughs, where you could know everyone. That way you could care for them and really feel you were doing something. Marcy would argue that statistically, leading his house here was more effective in creating general human happiness, but he wasn't a man of numbers. He was a man who trusted his gut. His gut missed knowing the people he served. Wax landed on a large water tower near a glass dome covering his octant's largest Church of the Survivor. People were worshiping inside, though a greater number would come at dusk to await the mists. The church revered the mists. And yet, with that glass dome, they still separated themselves from it. Wax shook his head, then pushed off along the nearby canal.
He's probably finished by now. He'll be on one of the nearby docks, listening to the lapping water.
He continued along the canal, which was cluttered with boats. Tindwill Promenade, which ran along this canal, was crowded, even more so than usual, dense with life. It was difficult not to feel subsumed by the great city, engulfed, overwhelmed, insignificant. Out in the roughs, Wax hadn't just enforced the law. He had interpreted it, revised it when needed. He had been the law. Here, he had to dance around egos and secrets. As Wax searched for the right dock, he was surprised to eventually find the reason for the traffic on the promenade. It was all bunched up, trying to get through a large clot of men with signs. Wax passed overhead and was shocked to see a small cluster of constables from the local octant amid the picketers. They were being pressed on all sides by the men, waving signs in an uncomfortably violent manner. Wax dropped through the air and pushed lightly on the nails in the promenade boards here, slowing his descent. He landed in a crouch in an opening nearby, mist coat flaring. The picketers regarded him for a long moment, then broke apart, taking off in different directions. He didn't even have to say a word. In moments, the beleaguered constables emerged, like stones on the plain as the soil washed away in a sudden rain. Their captain, an older woman whose blonde hair poked down straight about an inch on all sides around her constable's hat, stepped forward.
Thanks, sir.
They're getting violent?
Didn't like us trying to move them off the promenade, Dawnshot. Didn't expect it to go so bad so fast.
Can't say I blame them much.
One of the other constables, a fellow with a neck like a long-barreled pistol, turned to his fellows and hunched down.
Look, you can't say you don't have mates among them. You can't say you haven't heard them grumble. Something needs to change in the city. That's all I'm saying.
They don't have the right to block a main thoroughfare, no matter their grievances. Report back to your precinct and make sure you bring more men next time.
They nodded, hiking off. The promenade's knot of pedestrians slowly unwound itself, and Wax shook his head, worried. The men running the strikes did have a grievance. He'd found some of the same problematic conditions among the few factories he owned. Long hours, dangerous environments, and had been forced to fire a few overseers because of it. He'd replaced them with overseers who instead would hire more men for shorter shifts, as there was no shortage of laborers in the city who were out of work these days. But then he'd needed to up wages so that the men could live on the shorter shift income, making his goods more costly. Difficult times. And he didn't have the answers, not to those problems. He hiked along the promenade a short distance, drawing more than a few stares from people he passed. But he soon found what he'd been looking for. Wayne sat on a narrow dock nearby. He had his shoes and socks off, feet in the water, and was staring off down the canal. He didn't look up as Wax stepped up to him.
Hello, Wax.
It went poorly?
Same as always. It's strange. Most days I don't mind being me. Today I do.
Wax crouched down, resting a hand on the younger man's shoulder.
Do you ever wonder if you should have just shot me? Back when you and John first found me?
I'm not in the habit of shooting people who can't shoot back.
I could have been faking.
No, you couldn't have been.
Wayne had been a youth of 16 when Wax and John Deadfinger, a lawman who had been mentoring Wax, had found him curled up in the crawl space under a house, hands over his ears, cloaked in dirt and whimpers. Wayne had thrown his guns and ammunition down a well. Even as Deadfinger had dragged him out, Wayne had been complaining of the gunfire, shots only he could hear, echoing from that well.
Any number of the boys we run across and take down, any of them could be like me. Why did I get a second chance, but none of them do?
Luck.
Wayne turned to meet his eyes.
I'd give those lads second chances if I could. Maybe they've had their moments of doubt, regret. But the ones we shoot, we don't find them unarmed, hiding, willing to be brought in. We find them killing. And if I'd found you in the process of armed robbery all those years ago, I'd have shot you too.
You're not lying, are you?
Of course not. I'd have shot you right in the head, Wayne.
You're a good friend. Thanks, Wax.
You're the only person I know that I can cheer up by promising to kill him.
You didn't promise to kill me.
Wayne pulled on his socks.
You promised to have killed me. That there be the present perfect tense.
Your grasp of the language is startling, considering how you so frequently brutalize it.
Ain't nobody what knows the cow better than the butcher, Wax.
I suppose. Have you ever met a woman named Idashwi? A ferrochemist?
Steel runner?
Wax nodded.
Huh. Never met her. They keep kicking me out of the village when I visit. Right unneighborly.
So far as Wax knew, that wasn't true. Wayne would occasionally toss on some terrace robes, mimic their accents, then sneak in to live among them for a few days. He'd eventually get into trouble for saying something crude to one of the young women, but he wouldn't get thrown out. He'd baffle them, as he did most people, until he got bored and wandered away.
Let's see what we can find.
Five notes for one basket of apples? That's robbery!
Marcy hesitated on the street. She'd driven the motor car up to the hub for the governor's speech, then parked it with the coachman, who took pay to watch and refuel motors, intending to walk the rest of the way on foot. The hub could be a busy place. That led her here, near this small street market with people selling fruit. With disbelief, she saw that one vendor was indeed selling apples at 5 notes a basket. Those shouldn't cost more than half a boxing per basket at most. She'd seen them for a handful of clips.
I could get these at Ellen's stand for a fraction of the price.
Well, why don't you go see if he has any left?
The customer stormed off, leaving the card owner with her sign proudly proclaiming the ridiculous price. Marcy frowned, then glanced down the row of stands, barrels, and carts. Suspiciously low quantities all around. She walked up to the card owner with the high prices. The woman stood up stiffly, braids shaking, and shoved her hands into the pockets of her apron.
Officer,
5 is on the high side, wouldn't you say?
Marcy picked up an apple.
Unless these are infused with atium.
Am I doing anything wrong?
You have the right to set your prices. One simply wonders what you seem to know that nobody else does. Shipment coming late? Apple harvest gone bad?
Not apples, officer. Grain shipments out of the east. Simply not coming. Floods did them in.
Little early to be speculating on food prices, don't you think?
pardon, officer, but do you know how much food this city eats? We're one shipment away from starvation, we are.
Marcy glanced down the row again. Food was moving quickly, most of it, from what she could see, being sold to the same group of people. Speculators grabbing up the fruits and sacks of grain. The city wasn't as close to starvation as the cart owner claimed. There were storages that could be released, but bad news moved faster than calm winds. And there was a good chance this woman was right, that she'd be able to sell her apples at a premium until things calmed down in a few days. Marcy shook her head, setting down the apple and continuing toward the hub. There was always a press here. People on the promenade, vehicles on the streets trying to force their way into the ring around the hub. More people today. Crowds drawn by the speech, causing traffic clots in the regular bustle. Marcy could barely make out the giant statues of the Ascendant Warrior and her husband in the Field of Rebirth peeking out over the throng. Marcy walked up to join another group of constables who had just arrived on Aradel's orders, their carriages lagging behind her motor car. Together, they wended their way through the streets on foot toward the executive mansion. The governor preferred to address people from his steps, a few streets up into the second octant from the hub. They soon reached the large square before the mansion. Moving here was more difficult, but fortunately the constables from this octant were already in attendance, and they had roped off various areas near the front and sides of the square. In one, dignitaries and noblemen sat on bleachers to hear the address. In another, the second octant constables clustered and watched the crowd for pickpockets from the steps up into the National Archives. Other constables moved through the crowd, officers readily identifiable by the blue plumes in their hats. Marcy and Lieutenant Javies, who had command of the field team, made their way toward the National Archives, where their colleagues from the second octant let them pass. A mustachioed older constable was directing things here, his helm under his arm, bearing the double plume of a captain. When he saw Marcy, Javies, and the team, the man lit up.
Ah, so Aradel sent me reinforcements after all. Trusting wonderful. You chaps go watch the east side of the square, down Longard Street. Boundary workers are gathering there, and they don't look too pleasant. This isn't the place for their picket lines, I dare say. Maybe an eyeful of constable uniforms will keep them in check.
Sir, those masses are pushing up against the steps to the mansion. With respect, sir, don't you want us up there?
Governor's guards have jurisdiction, Lieutenant. They brush us back if we try to do anything on the actual mansion grounds. Damn pewterneck bulls. They barely give us warning anytime the governor wants to have a say to the people, then expect us to do the hard work of policing this mess.
Javies saluted, and his team ran off.
Sir, Constable General Aradel wanted me to bring him a direct report on the speech. Do you think I could get a spot on those bleachers to watch?
No luck there. Every niece and nanny of a house lord has demanded a spot. They'll gut me if I send someone else over.
Thank you anyway, sir. I'll see if I can work my way to the front of the crowd.
Wait, Constable. Don't I know you?
I'm...
Lord Harm's girl. The bastard. That's it. Now, don't get red-faced. That's not meant as an insult, child. Just what you are, and that's it. Simple as day. I like your father. He was bad enough at cards to be fun to play against, but he was careful not to bet so much that I felt bad about winning.
Sir...
News of her nature, once kept discreet, had moved through all of high society. Hanging around Waxillium, who created such stirs, did have its drawbacks. And her mother did have something of a reason for her angry letters. Marcy was quite accepting of what she was. That didn't mean she liked having it thrown at her. Old nobleman officers like this, though, well, they came from a time when they felt they could say whatever they wanted, particularly about their subordinates.
There's space with the reporters, little Harms. Up near the north side. Not great for watching, as you'll have steps in your way, but a great place for listening. Tell Constable Wells at the rope I said you could pass, and give my best to your father.
She saluted, still wrestling with a mixture of shame and indignation. He didn't mean anything by his comments, but rust and ruin she had worked most of her life swept under the rug with a few coins in hand, her father refusing to openly acknowledge her. Among the constables, at least, couldn't she be known for her professional accomplishments, not the nature of her birth? Still, she wouldn't turn down the opportunity for a better spot, so she began to work her way around the square toward the section he'd specified.
What was that?
Wax spun to look away from the group of beggars he'd been questioning.
Wax?
Wayne turned away from another group of people.
What's going on?
Who
Wax shoved through a crowd on the street toward the thing he'd seen, a face.
It can't be.
His frantic actions drew dark glares from some people. The days when a nobleman, even an allomancer, could quell with a look were passing. Wax eventually stumbled into a pocket of open ground and spun about. Where? Wild, every sense straining, he dropped a bullet casing and pushed, popping up about 10 feet. Scanning, he whirled. The heavy flow of people on Tindwell Promenade continued toward the hub, near which the governor would apparently be making a speech. That's a dangerous crowd, a piece of him noticed. There were too many men wearing battered coats and bearing battered expressions. The labor issue was becoming a bigger and bigger problem. Half the city was underpaid and overworked. The other half was simply out of work. A strange dichotomy. He kept seeing men loitering on corners. Now they flowed together in streams. That would create dangerous rapids, as when a real river met rocks. Wax landed, heart thrumming like the drum of a march. He'd been sure of it this time. He had seen Bloody Tan in that crowd of men. A brief glimpse of a familiar face, the mortician killer, the last man Wax had hunted in the roughs before coming to Ellendale. The man who had caused Lessie's death.
Wax? Wax, you all right? You look like you ate an egg you found in the gutter.
It's nothing.
Ah, then that look I saw. You were just contemplating your impending marriage to Steris, I guess?
Wax turned away from the crowds.
I imagined it. I must have imagined it.
I wish you'd leave Steris alone. She's not nearly so bad as you make her sound.
Well, that's the same thing you said about that horse you bought. You remember? The one who only bit me?
Roseweather had good taste. Did you find anything?
Wayne nodded, leading them out of the press of traffic.
Miss Steelrunner settled down nearby, all right. She got a job doing bookkeeping for a jeweler down the road. She hasn't come into work in over a week, though. The jeweler sent someone to her flat, but nobody answered the door.
You got the address?
Of course I did.
Wayne shoved his hands in the pockets of his duster.
Got me a new pocket watch, too.
He held up one made of pure gold with opaline workings on the face. After a short trip back to the jeweler to return the watch, Wayne claimed he figured it had been for trade, since it had been sitting out on the counter with naught but a little box of glass around it. They made their way up the road to the Bornton district. This was a high-quality neighborhood, which also meant it had less character. No laundry airing in front of buildings, no people sitting on the steps. Instead, the street was lined by white townhouses and rows of apartment buildings with spiky iron decorations around their upper windows. They checked the address with one of the local newsboys and eventually found themselves in front of the apartment building in question.
Someday I'd like to live in a fancy place like this.
Wayne, you live in a mansion.
It ain't fancy. It's opulent. Big difference.
Which is?
Mostly, it involves which kinds of glasses you drink out of and what kind of art you hang. You need to know these things now, Wax, being filthy rich and all.
Wayne, you're practically rich yourself after the reward from the Vanisher's case.
Wayne shrugged. He hadn't touched his share of that, which had been paid out mostly in aluminum recovered from Miles and his gang. Wax led the way up the steps running along the outside of the building. Idashwi's place was at the top, a small apartment on the rear, with a view only of the back of other buildings. Wax slipped Vindication out of her holster, then stood to the side of the door in case someone shot through it.
Nice door. Good wood.
Wayne kicked it open. Wax leveled his gun and Wayne ducked inside, sliding up against the wall to avoid being backlit. He found a switch a moment later, turning on the room's electric lights. Wax raised the gun beside his head, pointing at the ceiling, and swept in. The apartment wasn't much to look at. The pile of folded blankets in the corner probably served as a bed. With steel sight, Wax saw no moving bits of metal. Everything was still and calm. Wax peeked into the bathroom while Wayne moved over to the only other room in the apartment, a kitchen. Indoor plumbing for the bathroom, electric lights. This was a fancy place. Most terrorists claimed to prefer simple lives. What had led her to pay for something like this?
Oh, hell. That ain't no fun.
Wax moved over toward Wayne in the kitchen, gun out, and glanced around the corner into the space. It was just large enough for one person to lie down in. He knew this because of the bloody corpse stretched out on the floor, her chest bearing a large hole in the center, eyes staring sightlessly into the air.
Ah, looks like we're gonna need a new prime suspect, Wax. This one downright refuses to not be dead already.
Marcy's position at the speech turned out to be exactly as advertised, nestled into a narrow gap in the crowd formed by the side steps of the mansion's forecourt. Around her, the members of the press clutched pencils and pads, ready to jot down bite-sized quotes from the governor's speech that might make good headlines. Marcy was the only constable among them, and her lieutenant's bars didn't earn her much consideration from the reporters. Their view was obstructed not only by the position of the wide stone steps, but also by the governor's guard, a row of men and women in dark suits and hats, standing with hands clasped behind their backs along the steps. Only a pair of sketch artists who stood at one corner of the knot of reporters had anything resembling a good view of the governor's platform, which had been erected on the steps. That was fine with Marcy. She didn't need to see much of Innate to digest and relate his words. Besides, this position gave her an excellent view of the gathering crowd, which she found more interesting. Dirty men stained with soot from work in the factories. Tired women who, because of the advent of electricity, could now be forced to work much longer hours, well into the night, with the threat of dismissal to keep them at the loom. Yet there was hope in those eyes. Hope that the governor would have encouragement to offer, a promised end to the city's growing strain.
Mirabelle's rules.
Marcy nodded to herself. Mirabelle had been a statistician and psychologist in the 3rd century, who had studied why some people worked harder than others. Turned out a man or woman was much more likely to do good work if they were invested, if they felt ownership of what they did and could see that it mattered. Her personal studies proved that crime went down when people had a sense of identity with and ownership of their community. That was the problem, because modern society was eroding those concepts. Life seemed more transient now, with people commonly relocating and changing jobs during their lifetime, things that had almost never happened a century ago. Progress had forced it upon them. These days, Ellendale just didn't need as many carriage drivers as it did automobile repairmen. You had to adapt, move, change. That was good, but it could also threaten identity, connection, and sense of purpose. The governor's guards studied the crowd with hostility, as if seeing the crowd as barely contained malefactors who were looking for any excuse to riot and loot. To the contrary, these people wanted something stable, something that would let them sustain their communities or forge new ones. Rioting was rarely caused by greed, but frequently by frustration and hopelessness. The governor finally made his appearance, stepping from the mansion. Marcy caught a few fragmentary glimpses of him between the legs of the guards. Innate was a tall, handsome man, unlike his brother, who had always seemed dumpy to Marcy. Clean-shaven, with a wave in his salt-and-pepper hair and a trendy set of spectacles, Innate was the first governor to pose for his official portrait wearing spectacles. Would he know? Would he understand how to calm these people? He was corrupt, but it was a quiet kind of corruption. Little favors done to enrich himself or his friends. It was quite possible he did care for the people of his city, even while enriching himself. He stepped up to his platform, where a diminutive woman in a green dress skittered around, adjusting devices that looked like big cones with their wide openings facing the crowd. Marcy felt she should recognize the young woman, who was barely more than a girl, with long blonde hair and a lean face. Where had Marcy seen her before? She thought for a moment, then sidled up to one of the reporters to read over her shoulder.
Breezy day, blah blah, air of violent suspense, whatever that means. There. Attended by the curious ministrations of Miss Sophie Tarxell, the inventor's daughter.
She'd been making an uproar, writing opinion pieces in the broadsheets about her father, who had supposedly been a great inventor, though Marcy had never heard or read his name before those articles.
People of Ellendale. The papers would have you believe that this evening we stand on the brink of a crisis, but I assure you, no such problem exists. My brother was not the criminal they are condemning him to have been.
Oh, Innate, that's not why they're here. Nobody had to come to hear more about Winsting. What about the city's real problems?
I will not suffer this defamation of my dear brother's character. He was a good man, a statesman, and a philanthropist. You might have forgotten the hub beautification project that he spearheaded just 3 years ago, but I have not.
He continued in that vein. Marcy dutifully took notes for Captain Aradel, but she shook her head. Innate's goal was understandable. He hoped to preserve his family's reputation in the eyes of important investors and noblemen, and perhaps deflate some of the public anger. It wouldn't work. The people didn't actually care about Winsting. It was the deeper corruption, the feeling of powerlessness, that was destroying this city. As the speech progressed, laboring with explanations of how good a man Winsting had been, Marcy edged to the side in an attempt to get a better view. How was Innate responding to the crowd? He was charismatic. Maybe he was doing some good with his oratory alone, even if the speech lacked substance.
A full investigation of the constables will be ordered. I am not convinced my brother was killed, as they say. My sources posit this might all be the result of a bungled raid, using my brother as willing bait to catch criminals. If that is true, and they put my brother in harm's way and are now covering it up, the responsible parties will answer for it.
Marcy moved to the side, but her view was obstructed by one of the guards who stepped in front of her. Annoyed, Marcy moved again, and again the guardsman moved. She'd have considered it deliberate if his back hadn't been to her.
As for the floods in the east, we are sending relief. Your friends and relatives there shall be succored. We stand with them in the face of this disaster.
Not good. The people don't want to hear about aid going outside the city, no matter how necessary, not while things are growing worse and worse here.
Marcy moved again. Aridel wanted her to judge the public's reaction, but she needed a better view. As she finally got a sight of Innate on his podium, Marcy frowned. That guardsman who had been moving and shuffling and blocking her view had turned, and she could see a very odd expression on his face, like a grimace of pain. And he was whispering. At least his mouth was moving. Nobody else seemed to notice the guardsman as he pulled a revolver from underneath his coat and leveled it at the governor. Wayne prowled around the dead woman's room. It was too clean. A room where people lived should have a healthy amount of clutter. Miss Steelrunner hadn't spent much time here. In the other room, Wax inspected the body. Wayne left him to that. He had no interest in poking at a corpse's insides, even if Wax claimed it was important. Wayne, instead, went looking for more interesting bits of life. His first discovery was a small cache of bottles in the cabinet under the bathroom washbasin. Various forms of alcohol, the harder stuff, each a little gone. All save one, which was empty.
Port. Not surprising.
He took the whiskey.
Too much bite and far too warm.
He took another swig as he spun about in the main room. These fancy neighborhoods were too quiet. People should be shouting outside. That was right for the city. He checked the trunk beside her sleeping pallet and found it contained three outfits, each clean and carefully folded. The terrace robes were on the bottom. Creases had set. These weren't worn often. The other two were modern designs, the one on top more daring than the one below. He wandered back into the room with the corpse. Wax had removed his hat and coat and knelt beside the body in his vest and slacks.
You found the alcohol, I see. How uncharacteristic.
Wayne offered the bottle to Wax.
Oh!
He handed it back.
This murder is troubling, Wayne. I'm sure she felt so.
Too many questions. Why did she leave the village? And why choose to live here? It doesn't feel very terrace.
Oh, I can tell you why she was here.
Well?
Think of yourself as a sheltered terrace woman in her 40s. Old enough to have missed the chance to be a wild youth and starting to wish you'd done something more daring.
The terrace don't long for wilderness.
Wax took notes in a little book as he inspected the woman's wound.
They aren't daring. They're a reserved people.
Ain't we terrace?
We're exceptions.
Everyone's an exception to something, Wax. This girl, she left the village and found a whole world out here. She must have had an adventurous side.
Wayne indicated the whiskey bottle.
She did. I didn't know her well, but she'd sneak out of the village as a youth. That was long ago.
And she left again on account of the village being so dull as to bore the sense out of a scribe. Hell, even Steris would hate that place.
Wayne.
Our miss. She tried to remain conservative at first, so she got a job as a clerk, a good terrace occupation. She convinced herself that a nice apartment, where she was safe from the supposed horrors of the lesser neighborhoods, was worth the expense. Simple stuff. But then some workers at the jeweler took her out and she let herself drink. She liked that. Awakened memories of sneaked drinks as a youth. She wanted more, so she bought a whole mess of different kinds of spirits to try them all out. She liked port best, by the way.
Makes sense.
Now we find her with increasingly liberal dresses, showing more skin, spending more evenings out.
Give her a few more months and she'd have turned into a right proper girl to have a good time with.
She didn't get a few more months.
Wax took something from his own pocket and held it out to Wayne. A book, bound in leather, pocket-sized.
Have a look through this.
What is it?
The book that Death gave me.
Marisie fumbled for her handbag as the guard in the dark coat sighted with his gun at the governor. No, there wasn't time for her gun. She had to do something else. She jumped for the man and slowed time. She had metal in her this time. She'd made sure after being embarrassed this morning. Her allomancy created a bubble of greatly slowed down time, enveloping herself, the would-be assassin, and one other guard. She grabbed the man around the legs, but her speed bubble did the real work, trapping him inside as everyone outside became a blur. The man's bullet hit the perimeter of the speed bubble and was deflected. It shot out over the blur of the crowd, the governor's figure vanishing as, she assumed, he was rushed away. Marisie's lunge wasn't enough to topple the would-be assassin, and so she lay there half on the steps, holding onto his legs and feeling foolish until one of his companions hit him harder, knocking him down. She dropped the speed bubble and jumped back. The captured man struggled as other guards piled onto him.
So basically, with this hemallergy, you can make someone metalborn.
As Wayne flipped through the book, Wax noticed his cheeks were breaking out in some kind of rash.
Storing health.
Wayne often ended up with odd rashes when he did that. They sat in the main room of Idashwi's apartment, away from the corpse, which they draped with a sheet. They'd paused briefly in their inspection to send the newsboy for the local constables. Wax ground his teeth. Idashwi's wound, it was just like those described in the book. Somebody had killed this woman with a spike through the chest, stealing her ferrochemical talent. The book described the process as tearing off a chunk of someone's soul. Using the spike, one could effectively attach that piece of soul to one's own, granting the powers of the deceased. In the old days, inquisitors had driven the spike right through the body of the one to be killed, into the body of the person to gain the powers. That prevented any power from being lost. Apparently, coating the newly made spike in blood could achieve a similar effect.
He knew. Iron Eyes knew something like this was going to come.
The book had been written by the Lord Mistborn long ago to leave some record of the art known as hemallergy. Lesterburn's book said he considered it a crime that the words of founding, Harmony's own record, omitted references to the dark art.
So our killer knows this hemallergy stuff?
Yes. The killer used a spike to steal Idashwi's ferrochemical talent, then employed that ability to kill Lord Winsting and his guests. We have to assume that our killer could also have numerous other powers at their disposal, any combination of allomantic or ferrochemical abilities, or all of them. Did you discover anything else in your search of the room?
Not much.
I understand the motive here.
Wax glanced back toward the kitchen with the body.
But I don't yet have one for Winsting's murder. Or... well, I know of too many possibilities. I don't have the right motive.
What did you find in the stiff's pockets? You didn't rifle through the pockets? Wax, you're a terrible grave robber.
I was distracted by the manner of death. I'd have gotten to it.
The word distracted didn't really do justice to his emotions, to the profound shock, the numbness. For months, that book had been only an object of study. But now, its contents had abruptly ceased being mere words on a page and had become a motive for murder.
We're out of our depth.
They returned to the kitchen.
We've crept into the realm of the gods. Harmony, Iron Eyes, the Lord Mistborn.
Wayne pulled back the sheet, exposing that gaping hole in the woman's chest, right at the sternum. Who would know how to do something like this? Who would Harmony let know how to do something like this?
Ah, here.
Wayne fished in the woman's skirt pockets. He came out with a folded up piece of paper.
Huh. That's for you.
Wax's stomach plummeted. Wayne slowly turned the paper around. It was a sheet ripped from a ledger filled with numbers and sums. Scrawled across it in a different hand was a single sentence, a familiar sentence. The very words Bloody Tan had said before jerking Lessie right into the path of Wax's bullet, making him kill the woman he loved.
Someone else moves us, lawman.
A short time later, Wax and Wayne returned to the Ladrian mansion.
Look, Wax, I saw Tan's body. You shot him square in the head. That bloke was deader than a stuffed lion in a hunting lodge. It ain't him.
What if he was secretly metalborn? Miles could have survived a shot to the head.
Doesn't work that way, mate.
Wayne tossed his coat at Darian's. It hit the butler in the face.
If you're a blood maker, you've got to heal a head wound right as it's happening. Once a bloke is actually dead, no power, allomantic or ferrochemical, is bringing him back.
I saw him, Wayne. Twice.
Master.
Darian's folded Wayne's coat over his arm.
New equipment has arrived for you from Miss Ranette. She asked if you'd be willing to test it.
Ah, ruin! I missed her! What'd she leave for me?
She said I was to slap you.
Oh, she does care. See that, Wax? She cares.
Wax nodded absently.
All right, Darian, slap me. Slap me across the rear. Come on.
Darian turned away from Wayne's proffered posterior.
Sir, in addition to the package, Lady Harms awaits you in the sitting room.
Wax hesitated, impatient to go upstairs. He needed time to think, preferably with his earring in, and to go through Renette's package. They were always very interesting. But he couldn't simply ignore Steris.
Thank you, Darian. Send a note to my grandmother at the village that says we found the missing terrace woman, but someone had gotten to her and regretfully killed her before we arrived. Say the constables will explain the rest and may have questions for her.
Very well, my lord.
Wax pushed his way into the sitting room. Steris rose to greet him and Wax kissed her hand.
I don't have a lot of time, Steris.
You've sunk your teeth in, then.
She eyed him up and down.
I suppose this could be useful. If you catch the murderer of the governor's brother, it could be politically favorable.
Unless I drag some corpses out into the light.
Well, perhaps we can prepare for that. Lady Zobel's party. You are still planning to attend with me?
Rusts.
He'd forgotten all about it.
Our invitation has gone missing. I suspect Wayne is to blame. But it doesn't matter. You're lord of a great house. They won't turn us away.
Steris, I don't know if I have the time.
The governor is attending. You could speak with him about his brother.
More meaningless conversation.
More dances and political games. He needed to be working, hunting.
Bloody Tan.
His eye twitched.
There was some talk of the governor not attending, considering what happened today. However, I have it on the best authority that he will come. He doesn't want to appear to have anything to hide in these parlous times.
Wait. What happened today?
Assassination attempt on the governor. You really don't know?
I've been busy. Rust, someone tried to kill him? Who?
Some deranged man, not in his right mind. They caught him, I'm told.
I'll need to talk to the suspect.
Wax walked to the door.
It might be connected.
He wasn't a credible threat. By all reports, the man's aim was terrible. He didn't come close to hitting his intended victim. Waxillium?
Wayne, we've got to
get... On it already.
Wayne held up a broadsheet from the table. Evening edition. Wax had a subscription. The top line read, Bold attack on the governor in daylight. Wayne tossed Wax his hat off the rack, then snapped his fingers toward the butler, who was in the process of hanging Wayne's duster in the coat closet. Darian's got it back out and carried it over.
I'll try to make it to the party, Steris. If I'm not back, feel free to go without me.
Steris folded her arms.
Oh, I suppose I should take the butler instead, then?
If you like.
Be careful about that, Steris. Wax's butlers have a tendency to explode.
Wax gave him a glare, and the two of them charged out the door toward the coach.
You still need private time for that thinking of yours?
Yes.
Never touched the stuff myself. Causes headaches. Hey, Oid, can I get you right up there with you?
The new coachman shrugged, making room for Wayne on top of the carriage. Wayne climbed up, and Wax stepped inside. This wouldn't be ideal, but it would have to do. He pulled down the window shades, then settled back as the coach began rolling. He took his earring out of his pocket, the earring of the Pathian religion. His was special. It had been hand-delivered to him under mysterious circumstances. Lately, though, he had avoided wearing it, as the book made clear what it must be. Long ago, a small spike of metal like this had allowed people to communicate with ruin and preservation, gods of the ancient world. It was hemallergy. Had this earring, then, been made by killing someone? Hesitantly, he slipped it in.
Your fears about the earring are correct. It is a hemallergic spike.
Wax jumped, throwing open the carriage door with allomancy, preparing his escape while pulling out vindication.
Firing that gun would not have the effect you want, I think. Even if you could see me, shooting at me would merely ruin the furnishings of your coach, costing precisely 84 boxings to repair when Miss Grimes takes it into the shop next week. You'd be left with a new wood panel on the coach body just behind me, which never quite matched those around it.
Harmony.
Yes,
you're here. In my coach.
Technically, I am everywhere.
Wax trembled, mouth going dry. He forced himself to close the door and sit back down.
Tell me, what were you expecting to happen when you put in the earring, if not this?
Wax slid vindication back into her holster.
I wasn't expecting an answer so promptly. And my reflexes tend to be on the jumpy side lately. Your deificness.
You may call me Harmony, or Lord, if you must. Now, about what do you wish to speak?
You know.
Better to hear you say it.
Better for you to hear me say it? Or for me to hear myself say it?
Both.
Am I insane?
If you were, speaking to a figment of your delusion would certainly not diagnose that fact.
Well, you're not helping much.
Then ask better questions, Waxillion.
Wax leaned forward. He clasped his hands before him.
You're real.
You've heard my voice. You've followed my path.
A few whispered words when I was in a moment of great stress, when I was gravely wounded. Words I've doubted ever since. This is different. This is more real.
You need to hear it then, do you? Very well. I am Harmony, the hero of ages once called Sazed. At the end of one world, I took upon myself the powers of protection and destruction, and in so doing became the caretaker of the world to come. I am here, Waxillion, to tell you that you are not insane.
Bloody Tan lives.
Not exactly.
Wax frowned.
There are beings in this world who are neither human nor Kolos. Something related to both. You call them the Faceless Immortals.
Khandra, like Tensun, the Guardian, or the person who gave me this earring.
They can take the corpses of the dead and use their bones to mimic a person who has died. They wear bodies like you wear clothing, changing back and forth as they wish. They were created by the Lord Ruler using hemallergy.
Your holy books give few details about their organization, but everyone knows that the Faceless Immortals are your servants, not murderers.
Any being has choice. Even Kolos has the power to choose. This one, the being who wears Bloody Tan's body, has not made very good choices.
Who is he?
She is a member of the third generation, and you should know better than to assume everyone dangerous to be a male. Paham was what we called her, but she has chosen the name Leader for herself. Waxillium, Leader is ancient, older than the destruction of the world, almost as old as the Final Empire. Indeed, she is even older than I am, though not older than my powers. She is crafty, careful and brilliant, and I'm afraid that she might have gone mad.
One of your ancient servants has gone mad and is killing people.
Yes.
So stop her.
It's not so simple.
Free will?
No, not in this case. I can directly control a being who has pierced herself with too much hemallergy. In this case, I would act, for Bleeder has disobeyed her contract with me and opened herself up for my intervention. Something is wrong, unfortunately.
What?
I don't know yet.
Is that possible?
It appears so. Somehow, Bleeder has figured out how to hide from me. At times, I can spot her, but only when she takes direct and obvious action. Unfortunately, she has removed one of her blessings, one of the two spikes that Khandra must keep inside themselves to retain their cognition. I would forcibly control her if I could, but one spike does not pierce the soul sufficiently for me to get in.
Cognition. Two spikes are required for the Khandra to be able to think, but she is going around with only one. Which means
insanity. But something is wrong beyond that. She can hide from me, and while I can speak to her, she doesn't have to listen. And I can't keep track of where she is.
Didn't you say you were everywhere?
My essence is. But this thing that I am is more complex than you might expect.
Being God is more complex than a mortal can comprehend? What a surprise.
Wait, did I just get sarcastic with God himself?
Yes, you did. It is well. Few act that way toward me, even among the Chandra. It feels good to me, like older times. Since Kelsier, well, I haven't had much of that.
You can hear my thoughts?
When you have the earring in, yes. I gained the ability to hear you from preservation, and the ability to speak to you from ruin. Each had only one half. I always found it puzzling. Regardless, I know you have been reading young Lesterburn's book. I am not pleased that he made it, but I could not forbid him. I will trust that Marsh was wise in giving it to you. Bleeder can use hemallergy, but in a way that she should not be able to. Chandra do not have allomantic or ferrochemical powers. She has learned to take these and to use them to maintain her Chandra form. Fortunately, she is limited. She can only use one spike at a time, otherwise she will open herself to my control. If she trades spikes, she must do it by ripping out her single one and then falling onto another, digesting it and returning her to sapience. I do not know her game with this city, but I am alarmed by it. She has spent centuries studying human behavior. She is planning something.
I'll have to stop her then.
I will send you help.
I assume, considering the source, it will be spectacular?
In Wax's mind's eye, he had a sudden image of a being standing with hands clasped behind him, eternity extending into darkness before him. Tall, robed, back to Wax, almost invisible and distinct, yet somehow completely unknowable at the same time.
Waxillium, I have tried to explain this to you, but I did not do a good job, I think. My hands are tied, and I am bounded.
Who ties God's hands?
I tied them myself.
Wax frowned.
I hold both ruin and preservation. The danger in carrying these opposed powers is that I can see both sides, the need for life and the need for death. I am balance, and to an extent, I am neutrality.
But Bleeder used to be one of your own, and now she's acting against you.
She used to be of preservation. She has moved to being of ruin. Both are needed.
Murderers are needed.
Yes. No. The potential for murderers is needed. Waxillium, the personality you speak to, agree with your indignation. But the powers that I am, the essence of myself, cannot allow me to take sides. Already I fear I have made things too easy for men. This city, the perfect climate, the ground that renews. You were to have had the radio a century ago, but you didn't need it, so you didn't strive for it. You ignore aviation and cannot tame the wilds because you don't care to study proper irrigation or fertilization.
The radio? What is that?
You don't explore. Why would you? You have everything you want here. You've barely progressed technologically from what I gave you in the books. Yet others, you were nearly destroyed. I made a mistake with you, I now see. I still make many. Does that ruin your faith, Waxillium? Does it worry you that your God is fallible?
You never claimed to be infallible, so far as I remember.
No, I did not.
Wax felt a warmth, a fire, as if the inside of the carriage were heating to incredible temperatures.
I loathe suffering, Waxillium. I hate that people like Bleeder must be allowed to do what they do. I cannot stop them. You can. I beg you to do so.
I will try.
Good. Oh, and Waxillium.
Yes, Lord?
Do be less harsh with Marcy Combs. You aren't my only agent in the affairs of men. I worked quite hard to maneuver Marcy into a position where she could do good in this city. It is taxing to have you continue to dismiss her because her admiration makes you uncomfortable.
Yes, Lord.
I will send you help.
The temperature returned to normal. Wax leaned back, sweating. Hesitant, Wax pulled aside the shade. Wayne's face hung there, upside down, his hand holding his hat onto his head.
You done talking to yourself, Wax?
Yes, I am.
I heard voices in my head once too, you know.
You did?
Sure, gave me a fright. I banged my head against the wall until I went unconscious. Never heard them again. Showed them good I did. If rats move in, best thing to do is burn the nest and send them packing.
And the nest was your head.
The sad thing was, Wayne probably wasn't lying. Being unkillable, so long as one had some healing power stored up, could do strange things to a person's sense of self-preservation. Of course, Wayne had probably been drunk at the time. That also tended to do strange things to a person's sense of self-preservation.
Well, anyway, we're almost at the precinct headquarters. Time to go back to being dirty Connors. At least they'll probably have scones inside.
Marcy stood in the precinct station, with arms folded, partially to hide the fact that her hands were still trembling. That was unfair. She'd been in firefights numerous times now. She should be accustomed to this. But still, after the jolt of it all wore off, the moment of thrill and action, she occasionally found herself feeling drained. Surely she'd get past it eventually.
He was wearing these, sir.
Reddy placed a pair of bracers onto the table.
No other metal on his body, save for the gun and a pocket full of rounds. We've called in the First Octant Precinct's leecher to make sure he doesn't have any metal swallowed, but we can't be certain until she arrives.
Auradel picked up one of the bracers, turning it over in his hands. The dim room was a kind of balcony, overlooking the interrogation chamber below, where the assassin Marcy had stopped had slumped in a chair. His name was Ryan. No house, though they'd located his family. He was tied with ropes to a large stone behind his chair. No metal in the room to make it safe to stow coin shots or lurchers. Stone floor, walls made of thick wood joined with wooden pegs. Almost primitive in feel. The balcony had glass walls, letting them look down upon him without being heard.
So he's metal-born.
Lieutenant Cabarel was the only other person in the room. The stout woman picked up the other bracer.
Why didn't he use his abilities in the assassination? If he killed Winsting with fair chemical speed, like old Waxillium Dawnshot says, he should have done the same today.
Maybe he didn't kill Winsting. The attacks could be unrelated.
He fits the profile, though, sir. Winsting's bodyguards probably would have trusted a member of the governor's personal guard. He could have talked his way past them and done the deed.
Hard to imagine Winsting's guards letting even someone like that in alone with their charge, Captain. After a firefight where others were being killed, it'd be tense. Suspicious.
Down below, the suspect began rocking back and forth on his seat. The vents that would allow them to listen in on him were closed, but she had a sense that he was muttering to himself again.
So we just ask him.
Again? You heard before, all he does is mumble.
Then encourage him. You're pretty good at that, Reddy.
I suppose his face could use a few new bruises.
You know you can't do that.
Don't quote statistics at me, Combs. I've found I can make a man speak the truth, no matter what you claim.
It isn't statistics this time. If you actively torture that man, you'll ruin him for prosecution. His attorneys will get him off for sure.
Reddy gave her a scowl.
So send for his daughter.
Cabarel glanced over the fact sheet they had on the man.
We threaten her in front of him, but don't do anything to harm her. He'll talk.
That's specifically illegal, Cabarel. Do you people know nothing about Article 89? He has rights.
He's a criminal.
He's a suspected criminal. You can't continue to act as you have in the past, Reddy. New laws are in place. They're only going to get stricter, and the defense attorneys are increasingly clever.
The solicitors have sold out to the other side. She's right.
Marcy remained silent on that score. Of course, it wasn't really a matter of selling out at all, but she'd settle for the constables learning to follow the rules, regardless of the reasoning.
I think that it's unfortunate we've got someone among us who seems to be more on the solicitor's side than on the side of justice. She seems to know more about their ways than ours.
Perhaps she does, and one might consider that to be exactly why I brought her in among us, Captain Reddy. Combs knows contemporary legal codes. If you paid more attention to the very laws you were sworn to uphold, perhaps Daphne wouldn't have gotten back on the street last month.
Reddy blushed, bowing his head. Auradel stepped up beside Marcy, looking down at the captive.
How are you at interrogating hostile witnesses, Lieutenant?
Less practiced than I'd like to be. I'm willing to give it a try, but we might as well wait for a few more minutes.
Why?
A moment later, the door into their observation chamber was flung open, pushed by Waxillium as he approached. Couldn't the man be bothered to lift a hand from time to time? He strode in, tailed by Wayne, who was, for some reason, wearing Constable Terry's hat. Waxillium looked down at the captive. He narrowed his eyes, then glanced at the bracers on the table nearby. One jumped, then fell off the table, pushed by his unseen allomantic ability.
Those aren't metal mines. This man is a decoy. You've been duped.
Waxillium turned as if to leave. Wayne slouched down in one of the chairs and put his feet up beside the bracers, then promptly fell asleep.
Wait, that's it? You aren't even going to interrogate him?
I'll talk to him. He might give us clues that will help us find Winsting's killer, but it wasn't that man.
How can you be so sure, Waxillium?
It takes more effort to push on real metal mines, and that man is too obvious. Whoever did this has predicted our conjecture that one of Innate's guards was behind the murder and wants us to jump on this man as a suspect. They want us to assume we have the killer in custody. Why, though? Are they planning on something tonight?
Distracted, he walked toward the door.
I'm going to talk to the prisoner. Marcy, I wouldn't mind another set of ears.
She started. He was asking for her help? That was a change from making her feel guilty every time she showed up at a crime scene. She glanced at Aradel, who gave her leave, and she hurried after Waxillium. In the stairwell down, Waxillium stopped and turned toward her. He was wearing his rough's hat. He only did that when he was in full-on tough lawman mode.
I hear you brought this guy in.
I did.
Nice work.
That should not have given her the thrill that it did. She didn't need his approval. It was nice, nonetheless. He continued to study her, as if on the verge of saying something more.
What?
I spoke to God on the way over here.
All right. I'm glad you're devout enough to say a prayer now and then.
Yes. Thing is, he spoke back.
She cocked her head, trying to judge the meaning of that. But Waxillium Ladrian was nothing if not earnest. Rusts, often he was too blunt.
All right. What did he tell you?
Our killer is a faceless immortal. A creature who calls herself Bleeder. She can change shapes by taking the bones of the dead, and she's been driven mad. Even Harmony doesn't know her purposes.
Waxillium started down the steps again. Marcy followed him down, trying to swallow that. Mistwraiths and Chondra, those were things out of the Historica, not real life. Then again, once she would have said that men like Miles Hundredlives and Waxillium Dawnshot were men out of stories. They'd lived up to the legends to a surprising degree.
So that could be her.
Marcy gestured toward the wall, separating them from the prisoner.
She could have any shape, any face. Why are you so sure that this isn't the killer?
Because the governor is still alive. The creature who's behind this casually murdered Winsting in a safe room, behind a wall of guards, after intentionally starting a firefight in the room above. She wouldn't be caught like this. It's a taunt.
He looked to Marcy.
But I can't be certain, not 100%. So I need you to know what we're up against.
She nodded to him, and he nodded back. Then he led the way out of the stairwell and around the corner toward the interrogation room. Marcy took a bit of satisfaction in the fact that the corporal there looked to her for authorization before opening the door for Waxillium. The poor captive inside sat with his arms tied tight, staring at the table in front of him. Waxillium walked straight up to the table and took the other seat, settling down and putting his hat on the table. Marcy lingered back, where, in case they were wrong about the prisoner, she'd be out of reach but able to offer aid. Waxillium tapped the table with his index finger as if trying to decide what to say. The prisoner, Ryan, finally looked up.
She said you'd come talk to me.
She?
God.
Harmony?
No. She said I had to kill the governor. Had to attack him. I tried not to listen.
Waxillium narrowed his eyes.
You met her? What did she look like? What face was she wearing?
You can't save him. She's going to kill him. She promised me freedom, but here I am, bound. Oh, ruin. There is something for you, in my arm.
In your...
Waxillium actually seemed disturbed. Marcy took an unconscious step forward, noticing for the first time a small bulge in the prisoner's forearm. Before she could quote the legal problems with doing so, Vaxillium stood up and took that arm, making a quick slice in the skin. He pulled something out, bloody. A coin? Marcy stepped forward again as the prisoner reached to his head with his bleeding arm. Vaxillium wiped off the coin with his handkerchief. He inspected it, then turned it over. Then he grew very still, paling.
Where did you get this? Where?
Vaxillium grabbed the man by the front of the shirt.
Vaxillium!
Marcy ran up and put a hand on his arm.
Stop!
He looked at her, then dropped Ryan.
What is that coin?
A message.
Vaxillium shoved the coin in his pocket.
This man won't know anything of use. Bleeder knew we might capture him. Do you have plans for tonight?
What? Why are you asking?
Governor's attending a party. Steris says he won't cancel despite what has happened, and this is the sort of thing she's always right about. He'll want to put up a strong front, and won't want his political enemies to think he has anything to either hide or fear. We need to be at that party, because I guarantee Bleeder will be.